Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of September 14th through 21st. This week we're joined by Father Thomas Massaro of Boston College. Welcome, Father Massaro.
Great to be here. Thanks, Tim.
Father Tom, you are just joining the staff here for the semester as an associate editor, so we wanted to introduce you to our listeners. Perhaps you can just begin by telling us what you teach up at Boston College.
Sure. I'm a social ethicist, and within the rubric of moral theology, I teach courses on Catholic social teaching, on Christianity and politics, on sociology of religion, pretty much anywhere the Catholic faith intersects with the social sciences and kind of with the wider world, maybe outside the church vestibule.
I should know that you're also a columnist for America, and you've written a few columns so far, and the most recent is on the legacy of Robert McNamara, who passed away this summer, as you mentioned, might have gotten overshadowed by some of the other celebrity deaths, most recently, of course, of Ted Kennedy. But perhaps you can talk a little bit about your column and what's the legacy of Robert McNamara? Why does he interest you as an ethicist?
Good question. And I come along in kind of the late baby boomer generation, born in the early 60s, as someone for whom McNamara was pretty much already out of office by the time I was kind of aware of public events. Those with more intimate knowledge who lived through the Vietnam War era especially, or whose lives were affected by it, perhaps tragically, would obviously have a more knowledgeable sense of what was happening at that time. But even in the retrospect that people of my age can offer, it seems looking back that McNamara lived a life that has almost kind of Greek tragedy written all over it. A man of great capabilities. He received compliments from President Kennedy, who called him the smartest man he'd ever met. So clearly a man whose qualities, whose intelligence lifted him to a higher level than most of us will ever achieve. He ran Ford Motors. He ran the World Bank. He did a lot of things besides being Secretary of Defense for about 8 years. But the thing that really will mark his life, we'll always remember him as kind of the engineer of the Vietnam War, the escalation of troops in the early 60s, in the mid-60s, everything that happened around the Gulf of Tonkin resolution under President Johnson, and then decisions about the bombings of North Vietnam and just a number of very difficult decisions that affected the lives of millions. So the short answer is I see McNamara as kind of a paradigm of that kind of tragic figure caught in a difficult circumstance, a man of great talent, but who the end result of his actions really cannot be called successful. Ever since, I guess, Antigone and the Greek tragic figures of Sophocles and other writers, we've noted these kinds of people with, again, great possibilities, but also maybe an Achilles heel. And he certainly is a paragon of that.
He came back to the public's attention a few years ago with this movie Errol Morris directed, The Fog of War. I haven't seen that. Maybe but you can present that to our listeners and what it said about him and how he looked back on this episode.
Absolutely. I was very moved by that documentary when it came out in 2003. I think I got the very first viewing of it in the Boston area because I was fascinated even before then by McNamara, his career, and his expression of regret. He wrote a couple of memoirs later in his life in his 60s, 70s, and this was taped when he was 85 years old. I wouldn't have predicted, by the way, that a documentary featuring an 85-year-old man being interviewed, that was pretty much the whole documentary, some flashback newsreel footage was there too of the Vietnam War, that would ever win an Academy Award and a bunch of other awards for best documentary. But it did, because it was a compelling story. And it was based on the memoirs that McNamara himself had written. One of them was called Wilson's Ghost. I think the subtitle was Reducing the Risk of Conflict in the 21st Century. So McNamara was trying in his later years, really the last two decades of his life, I wouldn't say to exonerate himself, but at least to draw out lessons from the Vietnam era. And by the way, that includes the Bay of Pigs that happened on his watch and a number of other difficult episodes like the Berlin crisis and the Cuban Missile Crisis, to draw out lessons from that. And I have in front of me a list of the lessons of the war. I'll mention a few of them. McNamara, in that interview in The Fog of War, said, you've got to know your enemy, empathize with your enemy. He had a couple of comments about rationality. Now, of course, as a General Motors, a Ford executive, as a World Bank president, rationality was what he was working with, efficiency. But he did come to that conclusion. Rationality alone will not save us. There's larger issues, the hearts and minds of the people, etc. So in his later years, he clearly was reflecting with a critical eye on his modus operandi through those years. The technocratic rationality is not the whole picture of what a defense secretary or any other public official has to work on. I'd say the growing area was the area of ethics, which kind of haunted him in his later years.
Perhaps we can transition from talking about the legacy of Robert McNamara to another polarizing figure, Ted Kennedy, who just passed away last week. Here's somebody who also, following McNamara's death, there was a lot of people who still weren't willing to grant him forgiveness for certain sins in regards to Vietnam. There's an interesting parallel with Kennedy, who, at least in some Catholic circles, there was a lot of anger following his death about his support of certain pro-choice causes. But maybe we can take a step back and look at Kennedy's legacy over the long term. And, you know, what trends do you detect in his, I guess, almost 50 years in the legislature?
An immensely successful lawmaker, legislator in the classic sense of the word, whose fingerprints are on hundreds, I think roughly 1,000 bills that passed Congress during his, how many years was it?
46 or something like that.
Yeah, 46 years in the Senate. It's a remarkable record of achievement. One of the longest serving and most active senators in our history for legislation. Well, I have a word that I think summarizes his career. I haven't heard anybody else mention this since his death, but access. I really believe that the major initiatives that he pushed for, that includes immigration reform, that includes the health care reform, several rounds of it, by the way. That includes social services reform. That includes changes in the nation's laws on education, on just a number of other issues, special needs of people, Disabilities Act. They're all about access. The simple thing is the access of a wheelchair-bound person to a building, or an immigrant who aspires to enter the United States, what is his or her chance of getting in? Or people trying to get health care insurance, medical insurance, who couldn't afford it otherwise. If they can access these goods that they arguably need, it's an absolute need, then Ted Kennedy seemed like he was throwing his weight in favor of this, even at a cost, whether it's tax money or political popularity. So that would be my summary of the overall summary of his career. And I certainly agree. He was a flawed character. He'd be the first to admit it. The Chappaquiddick incident in 1970, the death of Mary Jo Kopechne in his car, and he didn't report it right away. The William Kennedy Smith, there were rape charges in the early 90s that Ted Kennedy seems to have been right on the spot. He testified in that hearing. And there were many other episodes. And I think that we can be critical of him. I certainly am critical of his stand on another kind of access to abortion, legalized abortion. We can be critical of him, but I don't think that we should dismiss him. I think we should take that, as we all deserve, a balanced view of his record, the good and the bad, put it side by side. There's parts of it we'll probably never quite understand. He and his sister, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, who died just 2 weeks before him, had a long dispute over this. She was very firmly against access to abortion. And, of course, in his legislative career, he pushed that. So very complex agenda, hard to summarize in a short sentence.
Yeah, there was an interesting column which in the New York Times today which contrasted the Ted Kennedy and Eunice Shriver approaches to the abortion issue, and interesting how the female Kennedy took a different stance on this.
The argument in that article, I just read it, is that she could afford to. He wanted to get the feminist credentials, and at that time, at the time of the Roe Wade decision in those years, there was pressure, especially on male politicians, to accede to that. So that's a very complex argument, and again, I was just a little kid when that was happening, but we can look back on that and say what we would have done, at least speculate on what other courses of action besides unlimited support for abortion rights were available at that time.
Now let's turn to the issue of healthcare. You mentioned access to healthcare is one of obviously the passions of Ted Kennedy's career and life. Maybe we can look to the issue of how the Catholic social tradition can help people to understand the issue of healthcare and what kind of common ground there can be achieved on this issue.
Well, absolutely. I think it's an unequivocal stance of our church that all people have rights. That's been part of our Catholic tradition, certainly since the papal encyclical in 1963, Pacem in Terris, from Pope John the 23rd. Among the rights we have is a right to reasonable health care. Maybe not everything, not the latest cosmetic surgery, but at least basic health care needs to preserve our lives. That's a bedrock of Catholic social teaching. How we get from where we are now, what political strategies, etc., will get us to the point where we can say we've achieved this in our very affluent society, it would be a tragedy if we don't achieve universal access to basic health care. So there's a lot of room for debate. There's ambiguity on exactly what the right strategy is to get there, who pays, how much, on what basis. But I think that's a really rock-solid principle of Catholic social teaching. And it's up to us, who are advocates for the less fortunate people, often those without a voice at all, to make this happen. And the hard part, the devil, as they say, is in the details.
Sure. I mean, there was a New York Times story just the other day about some of the divisions that are revealing themselves within the church about this issue. The bishops, the Catholic Health Association, have all come out in favor of some form of health care legislation, but there are a few bishops out there who have, I guess, registered some reservations, and specifically the abortion issue.
Yeah, access to abortion and whether that will, in some ways, some accounting techniques perhaps, be paid for by taxpayer money, which we haven't had up till now. So that will be a divisive part of this bill. I certainly, you know, it shouldn't overshadow the entire huge effort to make this dream of Ted Kennedy's and of many other people come alive. Every president, roughly, since Truman, has tried to get some kind of significant health care reform, insurance accessibility improvements passed. And it's just, as we all know, especially with Clinton in 1994, they've tended to go down in flames. So it's certainly a moral imperative, and how we do it, there's so much room for debate, and yet we really hope that the gist of the program, the central thrust of the program, will get passed.
Now, one obviously group of people that's affected, especially by this issue, are the poor. And in your first column for us, you wrote about the recession and how it has been affecting the poor. Now, if you listen to economists these days, they seem to think we've kind of turned the corner. We've avoided the Great Depression. We may still be in kind of a great recession. But unemployment is still high, so the poor still seem to be affected in a real way by the downturn.
Yes. I don't think we'll ever really know the extent of hardship of low-income people in this country, especially when the economy dips, because so many of these things are not measured, at least in the standard polls from the Census Bureau and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But sure, job loss can be measured. The number of people who double up in apartments because they can't afford rent, the number of people who turn to shelters and food banks, some of which is measured, some is not. One of the things that is worth noting is when we were faced with the question of the economic stimulus package, this is so typical of our country, we tended to look at a corporation-based solution or a bank-based solution. Let's have these kinds of bundling of loans. Let's reform some of that system. Very few people in Washington, at least, were actively speaking for let's help people stay in their homes. Later on, that got some attention. Let's approach the mortgage crisis with a consumer-based relief, not just let's make sure the banks can balance their books. These are the kinds of human needs-based criteria that Catholic social teaching recommends. Actually, if you think about it with theological lenses on, this is the option for the poor. This is the way that our church has called us in the last several decades to make a preferential option for the poor, the vulnerable, the marginalized, those of low income, to help them make their bills, make ends meet, and on a reasonable term so that nobody is desperate. So I don't see that our country has really adopted those kinds of approaches, kind of bottom up, making sure that low-income families can make ends meet. We tend to be concerned about the big players, the banks, the corporations, the insurance groups that are too big to fail. We bail them out, and we hope that the benefits trickle down to the low-income families, but I don't see that we are dedicated enough, at least for the purposes of Catholic social teaching and its principles, to those kinds of measures.
Now, how does, you know, obviously you're an expert in Catholic social teaching. What resources could a Catholic look to kind of bring this approach to the political process? You know, how can, you know, the average person get involved to make these issues, kind of give them more, shed a spotlight on them?
Yeah, good question, Tim. Well, the deep resources, of course, are the words of our popes and papal social encyclicals, the most recent of which was published this summer, Caritas and Veritate from Benedict XVI. Those are the source documents, the materials that we can draw from, big overarching principles. But of course, though, any statement that is uttered by a Vatican spokesman or a pope himself is on a very general level. It's appropriate for the whole world to get some information from. How does it get applied? Here in our country, of course, our authentic teaching, the teaching magisterium, is represented by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. So we look for things that bishops have said, and they publish frequent pastoral letters on social issues, statements from subcommittees of the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops, and sometimes with a fair amount of detail, not just on big like foreign policy issues, but on what should happen in consumer safety and the environment and all kinds of somewhat detailed issues with economic and political ramifications. But still, it tends to be general. What do we do today? What do I do in my city? What do I do in my parish setting? These are topics that we're all going to have to discern. There's no shortcut. There's no cookie-cutter solution. We all need to, on a local level, perform some social analysis, ask hard questions, the causes of problems, the best solutions to the problems, and to follow our best instincts, our reason, our experience, and again, our social analysis, gathering data, putting it into effect. And what I see most often lacking isn't the brains or the resources. We've got plenty of those, documents and smart people and think tanks. What we're lacking sometimes is the will. It's so easy to live our lives privately, individually, and not to get that kind of the bug of activism. I'd love to see a revival of a little bit more social activism, a little more a tackling of issues among Catholics, both in the charitable approach and in the more justice approach. And that's an old distinction in Catholic social thought. The charitable, of course, is the neighbor-to-neighbor, face-to-face, hand-to-hand assistance that you do when you can. The justice approach is a more structured, even methodical approach, making regular efforts, teaming up efforts with people, perhaps advocating to legislators in the sense of a lobbyist, but more often on the local level, just trying to change structures like access to education, the basic needs of people for food, medical care, clothing, etc. So those kinds of justice issues, changing the structures so people have a chance, that I think is the growing edge. And that I do see signs of hope that the younger generation of Catholics, people younger than me, people born after the Kennedy administration, will really care about their neighbors and change the structures that will help the people around them.
Obviously, you're in academia, but one way that you try to work for justice is this group you're involved in, Catholic Scholars for Worker Justice. Maybe you can describe that to our listeners.
Great. It's just about 2 years old now. There was kind of a lacuna in the Catholic world. We always talk about labor justice. Many of our papal encyclicals from the very first one, 1891, Rerum Novarum from Pope Leo XIII, were focused and dedicated to worker justice, the rights of workers to represent themselves in collective bargaining, etc. But it seemed like the academic community, at least in the United States, wasn't doing anything, wasn't organizing its voice in a systematic way. So we did develop, there's a professor at Manhattan College in the Bronx called Joseph Fahey. He got the ball rolling. A number of other people joined on early, a Dominican sister, Mary Priniski, and a Holy Cross father named Patrick Sullivan got together, formed a steering committee. I joined it in its later organizing phases. And now we have an executive committee, a steering committee, a membership of hundreds of scholars who lend their voice in support to particular legislative acts. We've been very active in the Employee Free Choice Act, which will reform some of the labor relations procedures on the national level. We've advocated for certain unions that were approaching a contract bargaining. We're trying to get organized for the first time. We've actually tried to keep a very careful balance between weighing in for the workers when they are in Catholic institutions, hospitals and schools, and when they're in secular labor negotiation with no church involvement at all. We want to keep an even-handed approach to both of those. And the overarching goal is simply to lend a Catholic scholarly voice to those incidents, episodes, but also larger issues, legislative issues, where labor rights are up for grabs and maybe weighing in a little bit, giving the moral support and a little bit of authority of the scholarly community could make a difference in urging people to promote true labor justice.
Now, perhaps we can end with a subject that you brought up in another one of your columns, which is the question of technology, how it has helped in numerous ways in our lives, but also how it has kind of come to dominate our lives. You know, as myself, I'm the online editor of this magazine, and we're involved in a new media enterprise here. Maybe you could talk a bit about what are the pluses and minuses.
Of the five columns or so that I've done, that's my most mischievous column. And the one where I did a little storytelling about episodes where I just encountered a great excess of people overly attached to their mobile devices, whether they're smartphones, cell phones, iPods, etc. Well, I see this as a long arc of an issue where contemporary people, here we are in the 21st century, need to kind of resolve, how much will I be dependent, to what extent will I be dependent upon technology? It's a great force for good. We all need it. We all use it. But can we draw some lines, maybe dedicate parts of the day when we're not going to be tied to our phones and computers? And I think the overarching, almost spiritual value here is mindfulness. How can I be aware, attentive of the people around me? If I walk the streets of Manhattan or Boston, I'm more familiar with that, am I open to engaging other people in contact and in conversation, even if it's a panhandler or an annoying person, as opposed to shutting myself off behind a wall of oblivion and being in my own little world? I don't have any answers to those questions. We all need some of these technologies to stay in touch, but the challenge is also to stay in touch with the people who we have casual encounters with and to be open, again, to nature and people around us. I don't want to be termed a simple Luddite. I'm not a simple Luddite. But how can we be mindful of the day-to-day existence that's not only electronically, keeping us in contact with people electronically, but also face-to-face?
Well, Father Thomas Mazzaro, again, joining the staff here at America for the fall in 2009. Also a columnist, and his column on Robert McNamara you can find in the current issue. And we'd like to thank Father Thomas Mazzaro for joining us.
Great to be with you, Tim.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. We encourage you to look online this week, where we have a video report from Fordham University professor James Fisher, who tells the story of the Jesuit labor priests from the New York City waterfront. And that story is taken from his upcoming book, On the Irish Waterfront. We also have a review of the film District 9 by the Reverend Robert Barron. A reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to www.americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.